Hallo und herzlich willkommen zur dritten Ausgabe des Krimi-Blog-Podcasts. Schön, dass Sie reinhören. In dieser Ausgabe gibt es ein Interview mit dem britischen Autor David Peace. David Peace dürfte den regelmäßigen Besuchern des Krimi-Blog nicht verborgen geblieben sein. Er ist die Überraschung des letzten Jahres gewesen. Er war der Shootingstar. Im letzten Frühjahr veröffentlichte der Münchner Liebeskind Verlag den ersten Roman von David Peace, 1974, in der deutschen Übersetzung 1974. Und dieses Buch bildet den Auftakt zum sogenannten Red Riding Quartett. Das ist eben eine vierbändige Tetralogie, die in deren Mittelpunkt die sogenannten Yorkshire Ripper Morde stehen. Oder die den realen Hintergrund für diese Romane, die ja immer noch Fiktion sind, aber in denen die Realität doch sich sehr stark spiegelt und wiedergespiegelt wird, bilden. Zu diesem historischen Hintergrund der Yorkshire Ripper, so viel sei gesagt, dahinter verbirgt sich in Wirklichkeit Peter Sutcliffe, das ist der Täter. Und der hat in den Jahren zwischen 1975 und 1980 insgesamt mindestens 13 Frauen ermordet, brutal verstümmelt. Und es herrschte zu dieser Zeit in Yorkshire eben halt ein Klima der Angst, ein Klima der Hysterie, und in diesem Klima ist David Peace als Kind und als Jugendlicher aufgewachsen, und wie er sagt, hat jeder, der dort aufgewachsen ist, seine eigene Geschichte zum Yorkshire Ripper zu erzählen. Er hat das auf wunderbare Weise getan. Er hat eben diese vier Romane geschrieben, das Red Riding Quartett, von dem bei uns bislang zwei Bücher in der Übersetzung vorliegen. Wie gesagt, letztes Jahr 1974 erschienen, und in diesem Jahr folgte dann der zweite Band, gerade kürzlich, mit dem Titel 1977. Interessanterweise hat David Peace mit dem Schreiben erst viele Jahre später begonnen, zumindest mit dem Schreiben dieser Romane. Er hat schon vorher sehr, sehr viel geschrieben, wie er sagt, aber die Bearbeitung oder Verarbeitung dessen, was ihm da passiert ist oder was er dort erlebt hat während dieser sogenannten Yorkshire Ripper Jahre, da hat er dann doch einige Zeit für gebraucht, und erst als er nach verschiedenen Zwischenstationen, er ist 1967 in West Yorkshire geboren, ist dort aufgewachsen, hat in Manchester studiert, ist dann eine Zeit lang, glaube für zwei Jahre, nach Istanbul gegangen und lebt seit 1994 in Tokio. Und erst dort, im fernen Tokio, konnte er anfangen, das, was er dort erlebt hat als Kind, als Jugendlicher, literarisch zu verarbeiten. Und ich habe ihn in meiner ersten Frage, die ich gestellt habe, danach befragt, warum er aus dieser Ferne geschrieben hat und ob er diese Distanz gebraucht hat zum Schreiben.
Yeah, I think the distance was very important, because the way that I particularly research and try to rebuild, reconstruct the time and place, I use the newspapers in the libraries in Tokyo from England, and also I listen to the music of the time and read books, say, from 1977 and watch films from 1977, and I'm able then to kind of try to recapture the language and the landscape of the place and the time. And if I was living in Leeds, I think that would be very difficult, because the language changes, and also superficially the architecture and the buildings have changed as well, but I still think actually though that the place is essentially the same, but it's, yeah, the distance is important,
also the time there.
Yeah I mean just to have just to be able to I write in a very small room in Tokyo, and just to be able to kind of that is that when I'm writing the book, that is that world.
When you went to Tokyo?
1994.
And then you started there?
I was. I left Yorkshire. I went to Manchester to study. After I left Manchester University, Polytechnic, I was 2 years unemployed writing, and they never got anywhere, did the books. So I went to Istanbul for 2 years, and actually I stopped for the first time since I was 7 years old. I stopped writing. Istanbul, I then moved to Tokyo to get some money to pay off my debts and my loans. And when I was there, I ran out. In those days, there weren't so many English bookshops or English, and I didn't have so much money. So I'd read every Elroy book, I'd read every James Lee Burke book, or every James Crumley novel. I'd read them all. You know, I'd read everything 100 times. So I just thought, in an exercise book, before I go to work and after I go to work, I'm going to just write the book. And so that's how I began to write it in Tokyo.
So you mentioned the authors. Which one of them are very big influence for you or your writing? You mentioned Elroy, for example, and some critics compare your work with Elroy.
Yeah, that's not a problem for me, because there are many influences. I mean, in the north of England in the 60s, there was a generation of writers we call the Angry Young Men. I mean, like, these are writers such as Alan Shillitoe, David Story, and John Brain. And they don't write crime fiction, but they wrote in a very spare and a prose that was similar to the kind of prose of a Hammett or a Chandler or a Hemingway kind of. And they wrote about the north of England. So they were an influence on me. And actually, interestingly, they're also writers, but, for example, James Elroy admires. But when I read Elroy, I mean, nothing compares for me. I mean, White Jazz, for me, is still possibly the best crime novel ever written, possibly. That's the book I'm always trying to beat. That's the book that I want to write, a better book than White Jazz. Because when I read that, I thought this was like, I don't know, when people talk about Stravinsky or or the Sex Pistols or things that changed, I thought that White Jazz, Elroy, had changed crime fiction forever. I thought he'd moved the language and the plots and the characters to an extreme level, and I just wanted to then take that and kind of go on further. He was a big influence on me, and I think in 1974 it's quite obvious that he was a big influence on me. Yeah.
So some critics call your writing some kind of therapy. Would you agree to that? You also said that you were obsessed by the Yorkshire Ripper. Is this some kind of working about your nightmares you had as a child and a young man?
Well, I think anybody who grew up in West Yorkshire at that time, of the Yorkshire Ripper, which was from 1975 through to 1980, when I go back now and talk to journalists and do reading events, everybody has a Yorkshire Ripper story, because you couldn't ignore it, and so everyone has their kind of different memories. I think for me, when I was in 1977, I was 10 years old, and I began to then like look for books to choose to read myself, and the first books I ever really, really loved were the Sherlock Holmes books. And so I was reading the Sherlock Holmes books in 1977, and then in my parents' newspaper, I was reading about the Yorkshire Ripper. And I cut out the Yorkshire Ripper cuttings and kept them. And I saw it as a crime I could try to solve, because I was interested, you know, I was reading Conan Doyle, and I was reading the newspapers, and somehow it kind of fused together. And maybe that's where the seed of the idea for the Red Riding Quartet was born.
And did you have much research about your books, or ever speak to people who were involved in the crime investigation, or maybe to families of the victims?
No, not as part of research. But for example, one of my friends, his mother got divorced, and she married a policeman who'd been part of the investigation. And so when I was growing up, he would tell stories when we were teenagers, and when we started going to the pubs, he would be in the pub and he would tell stories about the Yorkshire Ripper. And, you know, my father knew journalists who worked for the Yorkshire Post, the newspaper, and so it wasn't research, but I was aware of something of the atmosphere of the time. But in all the cases, I've actually avoided meeting people. You know, I've not spoken to people, because I've wanted to try to not be influenced by one way of looking, to try to get as much of the feeling, and that's why I use many different narrators. Yes. You know, I don't just have Eddie Dunford for 4 books. I want many different narrators, because I want different ways of seeing.
So this is a big scene, to get a big scene.
Yeah. And so, you know, by the end of the quartet, you've really got a picture of what it was like to, you know, of West Yorkshire from 1974 to 1983.
Yes, I see. You mentioned your father is a journalist, or was a journalist.
No, he wasn't.
He was.
He knew journalists.
That grips me to the another aspect of your books. It's very important, the media, the role of the media during the Yorkshire Ripper investigation. It was very important.
Yeah, I was interested in who was the person, who was the journalist who first used the phrase Yorkshire Ripper, because that then brought back all the kind of Jack the Ripper imagery. And, you know, that really changed things. If he hadn't been called the Yorkshire Ripper, if he'd been called, for example, the Yorkshire Butcher, you know, it wouldn't, it, you know, that would have changed things. And so I was interested in that. And obviously the way that crimes are reported, the way that journalists like policemen are put into situations where they're faced with things that ordinary people don't see. And how do these things affect these people?
Another very important thing of your books is the music in the books. You mentioned many music of these days. So how important is music for you as a writer?
Well, it's a way for me to, like I said before, to get back the language, because language changes, but within the music there is something of, you know, like I said before, I think that a crime happens in a specific time, a specific place, for a specific reason. Equally, I think a song happens in a specific time, a specific place, for a specific reason. So these things are very important for me, and they help me to, you know, maybe they spark a memory, or maybe actually an image comes to mind when I'm listening. So the very first draft of the book, I have music, but actually after the first draft, I can't, because it affects the rhythm of the writing. So the first draft has music.
Do you read actually a contemporary crime fiction today? Is there?
Well, I would like to read much more, but one of the problems is that I write, you know, but the way that I write and research is quite intense, so it's difficult for me to really find the time to read upper crime fiction, but I mean, I still do read some. I mean, of British crime writers, I do admire what Ian Rankin has done with the reboot. You know, as I said, I don't particularly like one detective in the same books, but he's at least, what Ian's done is he's moved. Rebus has grown up, like he's aged during these books naturally, and also what you have, what he's created is this portrait of, you know, Edinburgh at a time of massive change, Scotland regaining the Parliament, the whole issues of devolution, asylum seekers. He's really, I think, taken the opportunity to say something about the time and place. But I think these books sell very well, and he's very popular. But I think later people are going to see, are going to understand them in even more. You know, I think. Straight critics kind of ignore him, and I think it's a great shame, because I think he's a great writer.
And it will be something that will be,
I think 20 years now, 50 years of time now, you're not going to read Zadie Smith novels, you're going to read Ian Rankin in 20 or 30 years time, and you're going to know something about what the United or not United Kingdom was like, and I think, you know, it's the same way with many crime writers. It's almost once the time has passed that they get the recognition, and I mean, sadly, a lot of them end up being dead before anyone ever discovers they were any good again. I mean, I've been very lucky that I'm still alive.
You also mentioned that crime novels should document the real crime, or what happens to the people, to the victims, to the committers even. But isn't that some kind of contradiction to fictional literature?
Well, yeah, I know what you mean, but I think that the problem is that, you know, I see myself as a crime writer. I like reading crime fiction, but I'm just uncomfortable with the whole notion of it as an entertainment industry. There are, to me, three strands in crime fiction. There's the traditional English mystery, which is more like a game. There is the American attempt to find some kind of redemption. Do you know what I mean? Like some kind of religion, you know, to some, you know, but the hero solves everything and the world is a better place kind of fiction, which is the fiction I prefer. And then there's this kind of third strand, which is this kind of serial killer kind of the kind of Thomas Harris inspired kind of bogeyman kind of thing, which I actually think is belongs in the horror genre. I don't think it's anything to do with crime fiction. I think it's horror. I think if you don't put the crimes in context, even if it's a fictional crime, it's crimes happen. So it's better to go back to crimes that happened and not to make, you know, I did in 1974. I made up crimes and there wasn't, you know. I feel now I can't understand, for example, why I have swan's wings stitched onto dead girls' backs, because there's no need for that. The death of a child is bad enough without sticking swan's wings on her backs. Yeah, it was just you know, I hadn't got the compassion then that is necessary to write great crime fiction, I don't think. And I think, you know, like talking about Ian Rankin, you have to have a compassion for what you're doing. You have to be looking at the context. So it's not the who done it, it's the why done it. You know, why did this happen? And also the consequences. You know, consequences for the families of the victims, and consequences for the journalists who wrote about it, the consequences for the policemen. This is what I find fascinating.
And you mentioned in your article at the Crime Time that there is a lack of moral in these days. And do you think also crime fiction is some kind of moral literature?
Well, I think if crime fiction examines the time and the place, then I think I can see why it's, you know, but you have to have, I think then you have, if you don't have a kind of moral reason for doing it, then you're really just, as I say, making entertainment. And I think that, but, you know, we live in a capitalist society. Everything is consumed. So, and people have to live. So, you know, people need money, you have to live. And I understand all this. But I think, you know, are you writing this book because you have to write it? Are you writing this book because there's something that you want to say, or are you writing this book because you want a new car? I mean, I think this is a very different. This is very different, you know. And I think I have that kind of traditional image whereby people write books because they've got something to say, and if they've nothing to say, they shouldn't write books. They should get a job doing something else.
After the Red Riding Quartet, you wrote GB84. That it's about the miners' strike. Could you tell me something about that book?
Well, originally, The Last of the Red Riding Quartet was going to be a book about the miners' strike, but I felt it was, the miners' strike was so big, like the Yorkshire Ripper, it was such a dominant part of the lives of people for 1 year. It was very, very intense. I thought you can't mix it into, you know, an all. You can't somehow take these characters and put them in the miners' strike. It's not going to work. So what it does is, what I wanted to do was to tell the story of a miners' strike from, and it's got many different narrators, it's got like six different narrators, and it's people at the top, people at the bottom, people on the left, people on the right, the kind of hidden connections, the dirty tricks the government used, the way the police were brought in, the kind of crimes that occurred during this period, and just to kind of put it all together, and not to make a point, just to say, this is it, you know, and to tell really like a kind of hidden history. That I mean, really, that's what interests me, is the hidden histories. Yeah.
Looking back on the Red Riding Quartet is very successful. Do you ever thought this could be such a success?
I don't really look back. I mean, I kind of, like, now I'm writing a Tokyo trilogy, a book, three books set in post-war Tokyo. it worries me a little bit that it's a bit similar to the Red Riding Quartet, because it's, you know, different narrators changing, and it's police, Japanese policemen in 1946. Yeah, it's about in Tokyo in 1946, there was a man killed and raped 10 women in the ruins after the war, and they had to find him. And it's about this investigation. You know, I've lived in Tokyo for 12 years. I've got my wife's Japanese, we've got children there, and I just, again, wanted to find out more about this time and this place, and you know, and try to understand it. So, yeah, it's very much crime fiction. Yeah.
Soweit also das Interview mit David Pies. Da gab es dann auch die große Verabschiedung. Soweit das Interview mit David Pies. Ich hoffe, es war interessant. Soweit auch der Krimi-Blog für heute. Noch der obligatorische Hinweis auf die Bücher. 1974 ist bei Liebeskind erschienen. Ebenso 1977. Von 1974 gibt es mittlerweile auch eine Taschenbuchausgabe. Beide Bücher wurden sehr gut von Peter Tauberg übersetzt. Eine Besprechung von 1977 findet sich auf dem Krimi-Blog. Das war der Krimi-Blog-Podcast für heute. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und lesen Sie gute Bücher, lesen Sie David Pies. In diesem Sinne, bis zum nächsten Mal.